The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I am genuinely excited to introduce our guests. Tonight, we're here to celebrate the publication of Chloe Cooper Jones' new memoir, Easy Beauty. I only have a few chapters left, and I can tell you it's one of the few books in any given year that reminds me why I love to read and why books are so important. Cooper Jones is a philosophy professor and freelance journalist who was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in 2020 in feature writing. Her work has appeared in publications including The Believer, GQ, Verge, and New York Magazine, and has been selected for both the Best American Travel Writing and the Best American Sports Writing. As one enthusiastic reviewer writes, Easy Beauty is a rich, decadent book that rewards close reading. Anyone who immerses themselves in Chloe's writing will come away with a greater understanding of everything beautiful about the human experience and how to behold it. It just so happens that tonight she'll be in conversation with the man who wrote these words, Isaac Fitzgerald, a frequent contributor to the Today Show book segment and the best-selling author of the children's book, How to Be a Pirate. His debut memoir, Dirtbag Massachusetts, is forthcoming in July 2022. Please welcome Chloe Cooper Jones and Isaac Fitzgerald of the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Let's give it up for the Free Library. Come on, make some noise. There we go. You see folks you recognize?
Yeah, my buddy.
Your buddy Johnny?
I haven't seen in a really long time, which is cool.
We're going to give you guys an intimate evening.
We know we're competing against the Sixers in the finals, apparently.
That's so right. We hope they win.
I don't care. No, I hope they win.
And some beautiful, beautiful...
Who are they playing?
The Heat.
Oh, yeah.
I said as if I knew it totally off the top of my head.
The Heat, yeah. Speaking of the Heat, we hope they win. Yeah, yeah.
Do you want to give us a little heat? Do you want to give us a little reading?
Should I read just a little bit?
Yeah, right.
Okay, all right. Just a little bit, maybe from the end of the book, actually. Thank you all for being here. And thank you, Isaac, for doing this. So I'm just actually going to read from the very end of the book. And, you know, the only thing you need to know to make this ending make sense is, throughout this whole book, I'm really just trying to change something about myself. I'm trying to figure out what it means to be sort of more present in a world of other people. And I really struggle with that. I think because of my disability, I think that I both have been put on in a sort of a marginal space, but also have kept myself in a marginal space. It's a thing in which... Being sort of on the edge of things is a place of comfort for me in a lot of ways. And then I had a son, and it turns out that I had this bad idea when I had my son that you could be like a good parent when you were like around them, and then like your real self, you could just like take your real self out at night or something. Doesn't work that way. Johnny, does it work that way? You're a dad. Yeah, it's like they see you all the time, and so that was kind of terrifying. So this book is sort of this struggle for me to figure out how to sort of inhabit my present, my reality, both with my husband, my son, and myself. And every chapter takes place in a different city, and this is a chapter where I finally come home to Brooklyn, and I'm still sort of figuring out what it means to be in a scene and out of a scene. Wolfgang is referenced, he's my son, and Andrew, my husband. After dinner, the three of us go out for a walk. Everyone knows us. The ladies at the pharmacy give Wolfgang a sucker. We get a bottle of water from the bodega, and Wolfgang sits on the ground, petting the familiar cats. Nail salon, Chinese takeout counter, laundromat. At the edge of Prospect Park, we see a sign for a magic show. We should go, Andrew says. I don't know, says Wolfgang. What? My husband says, you weren't curious? Curious about what? Wolfgang shrugs. Wolfgang is like 7 here also. Curious about what? Wolfgang shrugs. Somebody doing tricks and pretending it's magic? Yeah, but maybe this time it will be magic, says Andrew. Maybe it'll be the best thing we've ever seen. Yeah, I don't think so, Wolfgang says. But he reluctantly agrees, and we walk to a field where many young children close to his age sit on the grass in a circle around the great Moody Trudy. I recognize a few of Wolfgang's friends from school, and I tell him to go sit with these friends, but he refuses. He stands in the back at the edge of the crowd next to me. The great Moody Trudy waves her hands over a fishbowl, drapes a cloth over it. She says a few magic words, removes the cloth, and reveals a fish swimming there. The kids clap and cheer, but Wolfgang is unimpressed. The fish was in the base of that bowl the whole time, he says. The great Moody Trudy starts another trick involving a newspaper. She pours clear water onto it, but when she wrings it out, the water is green. Newspaper ink is food coloring, says Wolfgang. The great Moody Trudy balls up the newspaper, then launches into an impassioned speech about the environment and the importance of not littering. She leads her crowd with a hand cupped behind her ear. Let's hear it, kids, she says. This newspaper should not be left in the grass of this nice park. It should be put in the... And the children all shout, trash can! And Wolfgang covers his face in disbelief and whispers, recycling, these idiots! The great Moody Trudy pours lemonade into a cup, starts to sip, and then pretends to trip, and out comes glitter everywhere. There was never lemonade in that cup, says Wolfgang. She does a trick while juggling balls. One disappears. I saw her palm it, says Wolfgang. Tell her, Wolfgang, I say. Tell her you're not fooled. Andrew glares at me. I know how you're doing this trick, says Wolfgang, loud enough for everyone to hear. I pull Wolfgang close to me. He reaches up to hold my hand. We are united, safe, apart, against the scene, but together. And I am proud of this. But the final trick involves a stuffed rabbit going on a journey. The rabbit, we're told, goes into the forest of happiness and emerges with a key to a secret box that will unlock the real rabbit. The great Moody Trudy lifts a box and puts it on a pedestal. She pulls a drawer open to show it's empty. The drawer has a false back, says Wolfgang. Where is he? Where is the real rabbit? Is he in this drawer? Asks the great Moody Trudy. And the kids all shout back, no! And Wolfgang shouts back, yes, clearly he is! Tell her she's busted, I say, nudging Wolfgang, and we both crack up. Tell her you've got her all figured out. Andrew grimaces. Stop that, he says to me. Promise me, says the great Moody Trudy. Promise fingers in the air, everyone. Promise me you won't tell anyone if I reveal to you the secrets of my trick. I don't owe you that, says Wolfgang. And we high five. Chloe, Andrew says, don't. But he's smart. Look how smart he is. He's figured out all the tricks, I say to Andrew. Okay, says the great Moody Trudy, time to meet the rabbit. And she knocks on the false backing of the drawer, and Wolfgang smirks and begins to say, see, I told you. But then the backing collapses, and the whole box collapses. And there's no rabbit there at all. And Wolfgang stops and stares. And the great Moody Trudy holds up a stuffed rabbit and says, I guess there was no real rabbit after all. And Wolfgang's face falls. The great Moody Trudy starts to put a stuffed rabbit back in her jacket. And then with a flourish, she takes off her jacket, swings it around in the air like a cape, swishing it between us and the stuffed rabbit. And when she pulls it back, a real one sits sweetly in her hands. The crowd erupts. Wolfgang, too. He's enthralled. He's seen something magical. How did she... I can't... Where was it? He says, beaming. See, not so smart now, you cynical little jerks, says Andrew. The Great Moody Treaty waves the children forward, offering to let them pet the rabbit. To my surprise, Wolfgang darts forward to join the line and, without a trace of self-consciousness, stares up with a face full of wonder at the Great Moody Trudy, and he tells her she is the greatest magician he's ever seen. He pets the rabbit gently, then nuzzles it with his nose, and the Great Moody Trudy leans down and they embrace. We stand at the edge of the park, and Wolfgang plays with other kids. And Andrew asks me, "Do you know what I thought?" while Wolfgang was standing in the back of the crowd with us. "What?" I say. "I thought," Andrew continues, "I went to school dances and I didn't dance." "Oh," I say, "neither did I." As kids, we'd both been compelled to derail our experiences when we felt excluded from them. We'd believed and placed all our self-worth on the notion that to assert yourself against the crowd was a form of higher level thinking, which sometimes it was, and sometimes it was cowardice. We'd not been great at seeing the difference, but Andrew is better about this now, and I am learning. "I didn't participate," he says, "and it might have felt good to be united with my peers, but I missed the chance to find out." "Right," I say. I look at Wolfgang, and I see someone smart and kind, says Andrew. I want him to be critical, but not at the expense of camaraderie. His compassion and his intelligence are complex enough to allow for both if we just don't what? If we just don't get in his way.
Woo!
Gets me. Still gets me. It's
oh,
so good.
Stop.
Oh, come
stop.
On. It's true. We're going to get to humor in a
well,
little bit.
Well, you know Andrew and Wolfgang, so you have
it,
a little.
It does. It really hits in the heart. Yeah. But I want to start with the book.
Okay.
And with your journey to the book, which is, when did you first know you wanted to write Easy Beauty?
Well, did my microphone go off? Can you still hear me? It's fine. Hi, Alyssa. We have a really accomplished author in the audience. I just want to talk about her book. Now she's hiding. She's put out a book called Little Rabbits, one of the best books of the year. I should talk about mine.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Although I do like the rabbit through line.
We'll talk about Alyssa's later. So the beginning of the book has me at a bar with two friends. And there's, I think the opening line of the book is these two friends are debating whether or not my life is worth living. And they were talking about a very common debate in philosophy. We were all philosophy students at the time, in which people argue whether or not a disability inherently grants you less personhood than a non-disabled life, or if it makes your life inherently inferior and therefore less worth living. And I had this moment where I realized that what I was doing while I was listening to these men talk about whether or not my life was inherently valuable, is that I was retreating. And I was retreating into this sort of abstract space in my mind, which I call the neutral room. And I was just waiting for the moment to pass. And I realized that I had done that for most of my life. I had just taken uncomfortable or painful situations, whether they be physically uncomfortable or painful or emotionally or socially. And I had just gone, well, if I just kind of wait for these men to keep talking, like, it'll pass, and I don't have to participate in these sorts of hurtful conversations. In this moment, I sort of realized for the first time that that also made me complicit in these bad beliefs, but that I didn't have the right language to really talk to them about what disability was. At the exact same time, my son was about 4. So at the beginning of the book, he's 4, almost 5, and at the very end of the book, he's 7. And, you know, if you have kids or you spend a lot of time around kids, like 4 years old is kind of, 4 or 5 is like kind of this magical age where they just start mirroring like all of your behavior back to you. Like when they're babies, you're like, whatever, I can do whatever I want. Like they're not paying any attention. They're just like sleeping and pooping and crying. But when they're 4, they like really have adopted a lot of your own behaviors and they're showing them back to you. So I was seeing all the worst things about myself in my son's behavior, which was a fear of strangers and a certainty that strangers were going to bring cruelty, and a desire to always be outside of everything. So he was in school, and he would always just sort of be on the outskirts, like not really fully engaging in his peers. And I knew that they're engaging in like a life with his peers. And I knew that he had gotten that from me. So those two things kind of happen at the same time. And I just made this decision to really, for the first time ever, start writing about disability, start thinking about disability, studying it, learning about activists who had made the ADA possible, and really try to think about not only like my own body and my place in this idea of disability, but also how to form a critical language to speak about it so that I didn't have to avoid these situations. I could engage in them in a way that was not just about helping me or helping my own life, but about hopefully changing people's concepts of disability. So that became a personal project that then became this book, the more I sort of worked on it, wrote about it.
It snowballed into this book. How old were you when that moment happened?
Well, this was like 2017.
Okay.
So I'm 25 now.
She's got jokes.
So let's see.
Yeah, but
how old? You're not supposed to ask.
No, but like 2017. What I'm saying is that it was you actually hadn't really tackled disability before that time.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean I hadn't written about disability. I hadn't studied it. But more than that, I didn't talk about it. Like I didn't talk to any of my friends about it. I didn't even talk to my husband, my family. I would do this really bad thing, which was I would pretend like I wasn't in a body, and I would pretend I was only a mind. And every time I would interact with people, I would have those moments where, of course, people clock you. They clock things about your physical reality, and they have a reaction to that. And I would think like, okay, so the thing to do is I see now the person is like, you know, giving me a look up and down, clocking my physical difference. So I will deflect, and I will tell jokes, and I will try to do some sleight of hand to get them to think about anything else. And I'll wait till this magical moment, and I would always think I could actually like see it. I'll wait for this magical moment for them to stop paying attention. Like they just kind of would forget, right? And sometimes people would even say this to me. They would say things like, you know, now that I've been around you, I don't even notice that you're disabled anymore. And I would be like, great, that means now you can see like the real me. And that, of course, is a really bad way of thinking because, of course, the only thing I was doing was I was in a complicated act of self erasure. There is no real me outside of my relationship to my body. And that relationship is in flux and it's changing and it's complex. It's not static. It's not something I even think I have any sort of full knowledge about, nor will I ever, but it is a really important relationship. There's no real me without that. But I thought I couldn't have any sort of authentic relationships with people until they forgot about my body. Mm. But then this amazing thing happens, which is if you are just sort of trying to think more, you all know this, this took me a long time to figure out, but you're smart. It turns out that if you try to have a more like integrated and authentic like experience with yourself and your identity and who you are, and you present that and you're not trying to like deflect, then you often give people a permission to more authentically be themselves. So suddenly that thing I was waiting for, which was like the opportunity to connect, that was actually happening faster and faster and more immediately the more comfortable I was with myself. So like always, like I was the thing in the way of what I wanted.
Which was that real connection.
Yeah, which was like the ability to be seen as like a real complex and whole person, mm-hmm. and to connect with people and for them to think I had value, mm-hmm. which gets stronger the more I embrace disability, not lesser.
Exactly.
But that did take me, I mean, a long time, many, many, many years into adulthood to figure out, yeah.
And so you decide to tackle it in a book. At what point did you realize that your family, that Wolfgang, that Andrew were going to have to be a big part of this book?
Well, it wouldn't have happened without Wolfgang. It wouldn't have happened without Wolfgang. Because I could have easily lived the rest of my life in this like kind of withdrawn, abstract space. And I got a lot of approval for that because I did PhDs and I taught and I wrote. So there was a lot of social reinforcement of value in being a brain only and not worrying about being a body. So I could have easily lived in that sort of withdrawn mental space for the rest of my life. And I also want to say, like, when I talk about this sort of this neutral room in my mind, this withdrawn mental space, it's not a purely bad thing. It's also a space of great agency, right? It's like the place that I thought about things. It's the place that I processed things. It's the space that I got with some peace from the world. So I think distance can often be a source of real strength. The problem is that for all of us, there's a threshold in which you cross from like peace and agency and strength to avoidance. You know, once you cross that threshold, avoidance and complicity sometimes and absentia that can hurt people. And I didn't see that threshold for my whole adult life. I didn't understand that threshold even existed, and I had no power to locate it because it didn't matter enough for me. But when I had my son and I saw him doing it, I thought, okay, maybe I have been living a life that's worthy of me, but I'm not living a life that's worthy of him. And so I thought, what do I really want him to have? And that section that I read, my husband says it quite beautifully, which is to be critical and to be thoughtful and to know when to stand apart or even against the crowd, but not at the sake of community, not at the sake of camaraderie, and not at the sake of like giving people the opportunity to be whole people before you're already discounting them, which was something I did because I just was like priming myself for rejection or prejudice or cruelty. And that, I mean, I can do that forever. That's fine for me, but it's not fine for Wolfgang. So he had to be, he's the home I want to come back to in this quest that takes me chapter by chapter all across the world. Ultimately, it's just like any other, you know, narrative quest, which I took a lot of inspiration from. I'm trying to come home to something, and it's him, and it's as a better version of myself to show him.
To be able to be an example to him.
Yeah.
But that said, it is a hell of a travel book as well. This book is so many things. For those that haven't picked it up, you absolutely should. It's so many different things. We're going to get to different sections of it. But one thing that you tackle in this book so beautifully is art and philosophy, of course, you having studied philosophy. So when did you know, you're writing a memoir, you're tackling disability, you have your family in there. When did you know that you also wanted to have kind of these thoughts and these moments and these interactions with either pieces of art or philosophy that mean a lot to you?
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, part of the answer is I wanted to write a book about someone struggling with something. Sometimes memoirs or nonfiction books that I've read seem to be written from, like, the cool distance of good hindsight, you know, where they're like, let me tell you about this thing, but now I've got it all perfect. And that's nice, but I was like, that's not helpful for me. So I, in some ways, was writing a book for that I wish I could have read, which is about struggle. So, you know, the character arc of this book is like, I'm a pretty incoherent self, and then I try to be a slightly more coherent self. And then the book ends. I mean, I read to you from the end of the book, and it's like, I'm just sort of getting a clue, and then I go, okay, goodbye. So part of this act of struggle, I wanted to be really honest about how my mind actually just processes problems. So I just genuinely process problems by thinking about what's in front of me, what that thing that's in front of me, how that triggers a memory. But I also am always reading things, so sometimes a piece of philosophy that I'm studying or a piece of theory or a piece of poetry or a tweet or, you know, anything, like, it will all sort of filter into my consciousness and how I'm trying to solve a problem. So I wanted to be really true to that. So that's one answer in terms of why philosophy is there. I mean, it's just as simple as, like, I was studying philosophy, so it was a huge part of how I was seeing the world and thinking about the world. But then the other thing is that, so I want to change something about myself. I want to be more present. I want to recognize this threshold. And so I looked to the philosophers that I admired to try to get some help with solving this. And one, both novelist and philosopher that I admire very deeply is Iris Murdoch. Do you guys read Iris Murdoch? She's great. She's fantastic. Very funny novelist, but also brilliant philosopher. And she has this idea that beauty, the experience of beauty, and when I say beauty, I mean it in all the different ways that we can conceptualize beauty. So physical beauty, sure, but also natural beauty, the kind of beauty we might see in a museum, the kind of beauty we find at a concert, the beauty of a performance, the beauty of that we find in an experience with other people. So we use that word beauty in so many ways, right? Like, Isaac and I just had a beautiful meal, but also, like, I call my dog beautiful. Like, what's the connection? I don't know. But she thought, Iris Murdoch thought, that the experience of beauty, seeking beauty in the world and with each other and in other minds, could literally do the job of shifting your consciousness. So she thought the way we see is informed by concepts, and the way we can act is informed by the way we see. So if we want to behave differently, we have to shift something about our concepts. And how do we shift our concepts? She thought you necessarily had to find ways of getting breaks from, and these are her words, your own fat, relentless ego. And she said, you know, all of us necessarily are locked in this palace of self-regard with our own problems, our own logistics, our own traffic, our own checking of the Sixers score. Like, you know, it's like whatever it is, it's like we're always in this like throbbing palace of self-regard. And it can be very hard to make any changes in our lives if we're just so self-focused, which is just being human. That's a necessity. So she said the experience of beauty just gives you a break. She has this great example where she says, I'm standing at the window and I'm kind of worried about a problem. And then all of a sudden I see a kestrel, the bird. And kestrels are very beautiful. And she says, for a moment, the only thing that exists is this kestrel. And suddenly I'm free of myself. I'm just thinking about this bird, its beauty, the natural world, like the wonder of that. And then when I return to myself, I'm different. I'm a little changed. And I feel calmer. And I feel like I've let the world in. And so she thought we could have that experience with each other, with art, with music, with performance. And she calls this unselfing. And so when we unself, we gain the power to change our concepts. So I really wanted to put that idea to the test. You know, it's like it's the driving thesis of this book, both explicitly for me, right? Because I want to change this concept about myself. So chapter by chapter, I'm seeking an experience of beauty in the natural world and in performance, in music, in Roger Federer, who I love very much and think is quite beautiful, and ultimately trying to find it with my family. And so the explicit project of the book is to test that thesis, but the implicit project of the book is to see if you can spend this time with me, you know, these 288 pages, and whether that experience of engaging in, you know, an artwork can shift your concepts at all about disability. Because if it can, then it'll change the way you see. And if it changes the way you see, it'll change the way you act. So my hope is that it feels like we're on this journey together and that we're doing the sort of work of of turning over the concept of beauty and seeing what it does to us. You know, what it does to our senses, what it does to our concepts, what it expands in us, and whether or not that experience or that thought of that experience can make us feel like maybe just slightly better people. Mm-hmm. So that philosophical question is just really core to the book.
It's really at the heart of it. I want to talk about, to be very, very clear, you have made a beautiful piece of art. I think it is absolutely incredible.
I think you said that on the Today Show.
Did
you know that?
I sure did.
What did you say?
I think it was something, I think the G word was thrown around in there too. like a genius work of beauty, like something along those lines.
Nice.
Yeah. Well, it's how I actually feel.
Oh, thank you.
So, but I do want to talk about, we were riding down here together, and I want to talk real quick, because I think Chloe's been on tour for a very long time. She's going to continue to be on tour for a very long time. But you haven't been asked a lot about craft. The sentences in this book are so, so beautiful. And you even clued me into a little bit of an Easter egg that I had missed, just to be clear. I think of myself as a close reader, but I hadn't caught this. But I want to talk, while we're talking about like what it is to look at art, to interact with art, there are things that we're reacting to that we don't even know that we're seeing. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could give us a couple of examples that are in your book.
The little secrets.
Yeah, give us some of those.
Just the little secrets. So I was really inspired by, I think with all artwork, there's always like a very conscious engagement that you have on one level. But I also think our senses and our subconscious, or things that are less easy to isolate, are also engaged. So one of the examples I was talking to Isaac about is like, if you listen to a really incredibly produced musical track, and then if you've ever like seen musicians, like, or maybe you are musicians or whatever, like break down those tracks, like sometimes there are lines of, you know, production that you're like, wait, what is this? And they're like, no, it's like a little hissing sound, but trust me, it makes the whole thing better. Do you know what I'm talking about? And you're like, I would never be able to isolate that with my own ear. I would never pick that up. You could play the same song for me 1,000 times, and I would never hear this little like tick, tick, hissing sound or whatever. But if you took it out, I would feel like something was a little less complete. I can't always name it. I can't always hear it. I can't always isolate it. But there's, I think when artists are really thinking on a lot of levels and a lot of layers, you just can feel it. So I tried to think a lot about how I could communicate the things I wanted to communicate in as many ways as possible. So thinking about structure, thinking about sentences, but also thinking about like sounds within sentences, or how long a sentence was, or how much tension linguistically I would put in a sentence. So scenes that are emotionally tense often have like harder glottal stops within, or shorter sentence to make a more staccato rhythm in your mind.
I'm sorry, harder what now stops?
Glottal stops.
Oh yeah, good old glottal stops.
Yeah.
For those that wouldn't know.
Just like harder sounds, like T's and P's and you know, things that you really have to like, that create a tension in your ear.
Glottal stops.
Well, there's a lot of, that's one of them.
But also staccato sentences, that one I know.
Staccato sentences, shorter sentences. I would just think about all those things. But then, because I do think you just hear it. You always hear language in your ear. And that feeling of reading alone at home for me, and just like savoring a sentence and not even knowing fully why, but knowing that every single syllable is very intentional. So like one of the things I did is at the beginning of the book, I talk about this thing called the neutral room, which was, it's a technique for pain management that a doctor taught me when I was young. So I have a pain disorder. I learned later that distance athletes do the same thing, where the idea is that if you're in physical pain, you find a place in your mind. And my doctor was like, it should look the exact same all the time. No one can come into this room. So mine is like a windowless cube. And then he would say, count to, and he told me 8. So this is my number. I count to 8. So when I'm in the neutral room, it's really like I totally dissociate from my body or from reality. And I see gray letters flashing on this wall. And I just count to 8. And so he would say, you're not actually in pain for a day, or you're not in pain for this long distance that you have to walk or this long subway ride. You're only in pain for 8 seconds, and you can handle that. And then those 8 seconds will start over. So I've heard like distance runners will do a similar thing where they'll be like, I'm not running 26 miles, I'm just running to that tree. And then they'll just focus on that. They won't let their minds go past that. And then they'll be like, okay, I'm past the tree, I'm running. So I have this sort of pain technique. And then as I was saying, like that pain technique could also find its way into social situations very problematically. So the first time that I talk about it in the book, I explain it and then I count on the page 1 to 8. But then in the following paragraph, every single sentence only has 8 syllables in it. So then when you're reading it in your head, you also have to do this 8 count with me. And so I'm like asking you to come into the neutral room with me a little bit. Now, no, who's going to pick that up? Nobody. But like, I just think it's cool. Maybe, you know, I had to read this book a lot when I was editing it, so maybe I'm doing it for me, kind of. But I just thought, like, I just want everyone to have to do an eight count with me because I have to do it.
And like you're saying, it's like the hisses of the things, like a lot of movies use it, right? The tick, 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 and we don't even know that it's there in the soundtrack. Yeah. There's music layered over it, right? But you in some conscious part of your brain knows that that's happening.
Yeah. And then, so another one is like in philosophy, it's a very common metaphor that the sun is like a metaphor for the truth. So in like Plato's Allegory of the Cave, it's like the whole idea is you come out of the cave of ignorance into the light, right? You face the light of the truth. The sun is the truth. The sun always hurts your eyes at first because the truth hurts. But then if you sit and you look at the truth for long enough, your eyes will adjust and you can see for a long distance. So that's the brief of the Allegory of the Cave. But all through philosophy, the sun is a metaphor for the truth quite often, especially in Platonic dialogues. So in this book, every single time I describe the sun, it's describing a relationship to where I am to this goal. So at the very beginning of the book, the sun is always like oppressive. It's beating down on me. It hurts me. It's like searing me. It's very painful. At other points of the book, when I'm grappling with things, the sun is really like moving and splicing and sort of affecting me in very specific ways. And then at the end of the book, the sun is golden and it's peaceful and it's encompassing this world of me and my son. One of the most important moments, I mean, this just literally was true, but it also worked for this, is my mother sort of saying a very important truth to me as we're on a beach as the sun rises. So every description of the sun in the book is supposed to be sort of mirroring my mental state or my relationship to this truth that I'm seeking. So,
and where you're at with it. That's incredible. I'm not going to, because we could be... Are there other things for us to look like? We don't have to go over single one, but
that seems like enough.
No, I know that's enough for right now. But like, are there others?
Oh,
that's
yeah,
all I'm saying.
Yeah,
like, just like
others. Yeah,
people can figure them out, like puzzles.
Yeah, because like I thought, I wanted to also write a book that someone might feel like they could read again in their life, or that might stay with them. And I mean, some of my favorite books, I don't even read all of them over and over again, but I just like. There's certain books that I just come back to and just open for guidance, like reading Tea Leaves almost. And I'll just read a couple sentences from them and feel like given something. So I wanted to write a book that someone could theoretically read twice and find something new in. But also I found that sometimes like people have a misconception that memoirs aren't crafted. Mm-hmm. And I think that has been a real... thing that I found on tour, actually talking to readers, is like, well, is this a memoir or is this like a book of crap? You know, it's like, well, it can be both. Mm-hmm. But I think some people have, not you, you're all sophisticated, but
and beautiful,
and you don't like the Sixers, and you know, so like,
it's not good.
No, don't like, go far. I just remembered this was being recorded for a podcast. I love Philadelphia. I love
there
the Sixers. Go Sixers. No, but like, some people were really like, a memoir is just your story that you like. Give to people.
Just write down and put it out there.
Yeah. And I was like, no, I think there are memoirs that are written with every bit of craft and intention and thought as any novel. And I really wanted to write a very highly intentional book that was in a dialogue with the art that I really loved. And I also wanted to write a book that felt like it was for other people and about other people and not actually about me, but that I was just someone who was processing a problem that I hope feels relevant to other people. So, yeah.
And that you're honing in a way that somebody would, be it fiction or even another piece of artwork like a sculpture or a painting. So to that point, and then I'm going to open it up so people start getting your questions ready, start percolating on those. We're going to open it up to this incredibly attractive, very smart audience who love the Sixers.
Yeah.
But I want to, two quick questions basically at the end. Talking about art, can you just talk a little bit about either be it your favorite pieces of art or your interactions with art, because that is also such a large part of this book and our friendship. You brought me to an artistic experience that I'd never had before. And then I got one last after that.
Yeah, I mean, one of the pieces of art that's really important in the book is Richard Serra's sculptures at Dia Beacon. And if are you familiar with Richard Serra's sculptures? Like, one thing that's very cool about his sculptures is you can often go inside them. And these four sculptures that are at Dia Beacon are called the Torqued Ellipses. And he had this idea, Richard Serra had this idea for a shape that's actually mathematically impossible to make. And so when he was trying to fabricate it, like, these huge sculptures, they just kept breaking, and people were like, you can't make the shape because it doesn't exist. Like, you're asking us to torque a thing at an angle that is literally impossible to do it. And then he was actually able to fabricate it through this one place in Baltimore. This is not important, but they figured it out. And so the experience of walking inside of these Richard Serra sculptures is that the walls that you're in between, they come in and they come out like this in a shape that doesn't make sense. So the experience of being inside them is that your mind keeps wanting to autocomplete what you're going to see next. It keeps going, I know how this turn will follow, but because you're actually inside a shape that's you've never seen before, you keep being wrong. And so every single step inside the sculpture is your brain going, I know how this is going to go, and then you're literally wrong. And it can be really disorienting. And the first time I ever went inside these sculptures, I really felt like I was hallucinating. I was like, did I die and this is like a coma? Or like, I don't know. Like, it felt so surreal to me to be constantly my brain wanting to tell me what the next thing was, and then my perception shifting and it being wrong and wrong and wrong. And that, I think, was a very important, you know, metaphor for this book, certainly, and the experience that I was having, this idea that I knew who I was in the world, or I knew what other people were going to do or how they were going to react to me, and then really testing that and being wrong and wrong and wrong. And I asked Isaac to come with me. This would have been a year ago or something. And I kind of was like, you're either going to really like this experience, or it's going to kind of freak you out and it's going to tell me everything I need to know about you, right? Like, because people who are kind of into that, who are like, this is cool. Like, I like being wrong, or I like being thrown off, or I like actually being disoriented. I like the unexpected. I like the new. I like the strange. Like, those are people who quite often are really open to me, or are really open to other people, are very accepting of like the wide range of humanity. And then I've been with people at that museum who are like, I hate this and I feel so uncomfortable. And I think that's very telling. But you felt good. You liked it.
Oh, yeah. I loved them. I thought they were very cool. I didn't know that tidbit was going to turn into a compliment of me, but I will take it.
I think you knew.
Oh, I had a blast. No. I was ready to get a surfboard out, just get on those metal waves. It was
like, I know, they were wild.
Also,
yeah.
There was a big hole in that building that I really liked. I was really drawn to that.
Yeah, the hole, yeah.
I don't know
the
exactly.
Michael Holzer holes, yeah.
See, you know this stuff.
I do, and I
don't.
That's okay.
That's why you are a doctor.
You have
But the last thing I want to say, and then we're going to open it up to questions from the audience, is there is another part of this that, like, we're talking about this book, and you're going to buy it because you're so thrilled, and there's so many concepts that you're being tackled here, but one thing I want to leave you with is that it's also incredibly humorful. Why was it important to you to make this book funny?
Well, I think that if you're really being honest about anything, even really awful things, if you're looking at them directly, they're really funny. Like, almost everything has an aspect of humor. In fact, the worst moments of my life are also completely absurd and hysterical. And I didn't want to shy away from that. Like, some of the more uncomfortable encounters in this book where people are saying pretty awful things to me are also so funny and, like, just weird. And I love that. I love that that's just the life, right? Like, life is a vast series of experiences and tones. And if I want to write truthfully about it, it necessarily encompasses things like humor, like self-pity, like melodrama, like, you know, egotistical ideas, fearful things. So it was important to me that I was honest about all those sides of who I am, but that also the tone reflected, you know, just real life, which is not, even in its most serious moments, not so serious too. You know, it's just like those things are always in tension.
Because there's the great Trudy Moody.
Yeah, because the great, you know, it's like, here we're at this stupid magic show, And the great Moody Trudy, which is hysterical. And my son and I, like, and I love that moment because my son and I are like high-fiving, being like, let's show Moody Trudy what's up. You know, and I just think it's this great moment. And then, of course, it's this moment again in which I'm showing my son that you should use your intellect as a weapon against people, which, of course, is not what I want to teach him, but it's always what I was doing. And so that moment is, like, quite painful and quite, and I don't look so good, right? I'm doing the wrong thing as a parent, but also is, like, very funny.
Mm-hmm. And also, it's not what you're expecting when you come around that curve.
Yeah, right.
Like, Wolfgang was not expecting there to all of a sudden be a real bunny there.
He does still bring this up. We've gone to a couple magic shows since. This is my son's favorite part of the book. I wish he was here. Because he'll see, like, we've gone to a couple magic shows since, and he will try to really engage, but then he'll also be like, I saw him mess up right there. Like, he still has that. And I still love it. But, you know, Andrew's point at the end is, like, don't do that. I guess, like, don't always put yourself against things. And I think for my son, it's, like, that fear of that he's going to be rejected first. And I don't want to pass that on. And I think intelligence is a way in which he is capable, because he's a smart kid, of separating himself unhelpfully, you know, like standing away, rather than using his warmth and intelligence as a way to really make a difference or connect to people. So that is, yeah, that's a really important tension in this book. I hope it's one that makes sense to people, you know, like I think we all have our own neutral rooms. I think we all have our own deflection techniques. So I don't think that's unique to him or to me. Yeah,
but it's important to be open to the unexpected.
Yeah.
Well, let's give a round of applause to Chloe Cooper Jones. And now we're going to open it up to any thoughtful questions that you all might have. We got woo real quick.
Oh,
we
fast.
Loved it.
I love that. Nobody ever wants to ask the first question, so I love this. Thank you.
It's just, I wanted to know, what are some of the books you read like tea leaves?
Mm.
Great question. I think James Salter's Light Years for language. So I just think Sentence to Sentence, that is a book that I feel really, I can just see so much in. I think Iris Murdoch's Essays About Ethics, those are essays I come back to over and over. The poems of Arthur Z., I come back to again and again. And then right now when I've been thinking about like clarity and specificity in language, I've been thinking about this book that just came out a week ago, Little Rabbit by Alyssa Song Sirade, who's right there.
We should just clap.
But really, I'm not even kidding. Like, she wrote, I think, one of the best novels I've read in a really long time. And I think the thing that really amazes me about her book and why I read it again and again and again is that it's so, her sentences are so, they're like cut by, like, they're just, they're little marvels. They're little like tight jewels. And as you've figured out, I can be kind of long-winded. So sometimes I just need someone to say something with such a clear breath, like a singular, you know, brush stroke, an intentional stroke. And I think Alyssa's sentences do that. So I'm a great admirer of hers and hope you'll get her book as well.
I also hear it's sexy.
It's super sexy.
Yeah, let's sell it. There it is.
It's really good.
Great question. Go ahead, right next.
I really enjoyed your talk, and I was really taken by your discussion of complicity. Mm. I'm just wondering if you know, it seems like such an expansive way to meet people and to like reflect on that.
Mm-hmm.
I just wonder if you have like a complex, I mean, I'm sure the answer is yes. If you have a complex relationship to your own sense of complicity, if it brings up regret or resentment that it even has to exist, or I'm just curious about that a little bit.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, in some ways, I mean, I try not to regret too much because I think regret can be a way of avoiding progress in the future, right? Like, if I circle my own regret for too long, I don't give the energy to just how I want to be in the future. But there are times where I look back at like the entirety of my 20s, which I'm only halfway through. the entirety of my 20s, and I think that's like a lost decade, because I like wasn't in any way like able to be authentically myself. Like I had a lot of friends that I cared about, or I had relationships that I cared about, but I was always hiding a part of myself, and I was always like in a deep shame relationship to a thing that really I should be very like excited about and proud about, which is like the strength of my body. And I think that that relationship, and maybe this is true for all of us, I think you could actually track the way I felt about my body onto like a geographical map. And but what I mean by that is I thought there were only certain places I could go and only certain places I belonged. I had to live in a city because when I was in a small town, too many people thought I was weird. I could only go to certain bars. I could only be sort of in certain scenes. I felt like I had to just only go to these places in which I would be comfortable or ignored successfully or whatever it is. And I look back at that literal geography and I think, I was so limited. like my feet, and it wasn't even other people doing it. It was me. Like I'm complicit in my own marginalization. I'm in an incredible dialogue with it. And for my entire 20s, I think that dialogue was so one-sided to the point of like dramatically limiting me. And in this book, I tried very literally to move outside of that geography by going to a different city across the whole world, but also putting myself and my body in places where I don't think I belong, where I think people will look at me. Like, I was a sports journalist for a year. And part of that project of being a tennis journalist for a year was I kind of thought athletes would be like very freaked out by me and not want to be around me. And the thing is that was true in some cases. So my worst fears did come true. But then also all these other things came true too, like Roger Federer and I are best friends. So it was like, yes, the bad things happened and the struggle all happened. But then all these incredible things happened too. So I do look back and I think, God, I wish I had gotten further. And I hope my son doesn't waste as much time as I do, or as I did.
Not to be a therapist, but not wasted time. Just time you're working through, you know?
Maybe. I mean, yeah, I got, I'm here.
Thank you for inviting us so candidly into how you're concerned about what people thought of you. Could you tell us a little bit more about the fact that they must have been concerned about what you thought of them and your responsibility in dealing with that?
Yeah. Well, I didn't think about it, right? I was like, oh, everything's happening to me. The world is happening to me. Everyone's looking at me. Everyone's doesn't like me. And of course, like the actual truth is like nobody cares about you. like nobody's thinking about you most of the time, or they're thinking about you for a second. But the thing is like, I think the thing that I forgot is that the thing I was worried about is just a human experience and not an experience of disability. And this is what I mean, is that all of us have felt what I'm about to describe, I would think, which is that, you know, we live in a world of strangers, so we have to move around this very scary world of all these minds that we can't understand. So the way that every mind handles that is that they look quickly, they isolate typically one visual fact about you, and then they reach back into their concept bag for a set of ideas about you. Okay, you look like this, and that means this, and then they have that first thought about you, and then they have no more thoughts, right? They don't have a second or third or fourth thought. And we've all felt that probably walking through public spaces, right? Being at grocery stores, being at concerts, being, you know, in a city street, this sort of wave of eyes reflecting back that first thought, first thought, first thought, first thought. And if that first thought is, for me, which is typically the case, is like pity, concern, fear, disgust, worry, those are a lot of things that are associated with a disabled body, then that's all I saw. I just saw that reflected over and over again. And you can't help but internalize that. But of course, like what you're saying is, I was also doing that to other people, right? I was doing that too. And I was also letting all of my bad concepts reduce the number of thoughts I was willing to have about everyone else. So a big project of this book is, number one, like there's no villains in this book. There are certain people who say unkind things to me, but I always try to give them a second and a third and a fourth thought. In many ways, this book is me trying to stretch my empathy as far as it will go, and by recognizing my own bad behavior in this thing that I so desperately want changed for me. So that, you know, just really sitting with that, what it means to give everybody, including people who are hurting you, a second or third or fourth thought, that became a really important project of the book, and it was a project of me recognizing my own gaze, one that I had not given enough time or true critical thought to before.
Do you want one about your parents or about Beyonce?
Beyonce, please.
So you use celebrity in the book as a framing device as well. Mm-hmm. Beyonce, Peter Dinklage, Roger Federer primarily. And all of them tie really beautifully into the themes,
Thank you. They're
all great stories. But I was wondering if there was an element of universality that made you lean on them in that way, or what is it about celebrity that was interesting as a way of framing the story?
So I think it's less celebrity that's interesting to me and more what we can get from the experience of performance, right? So for me, I had this idea that I couldn't, you know, I have this Beyonce experience where a student tells me, you have to go see Beyonce. She's like, I had this epiphany at a Beyonce concert. And I was like, well, I won't have one and I won't go to one. And I'll be a little snob about it because I was just scared to go to a concert because I knew that would be a physically uncomfortable space for me. So I reject this feeling. And the thing, there's so many things we could say about Beyonce that are amazing that you could have any sort of experience with her. But it wasn't her physical beauty, which is considerable. That's not the thing that has an effect on me in this book. It's not her music, which is great. It's not her voice, which is incredible. It's not the spectacle of her shows, which is considerable. It was just the way in which she was capable of being completely present on a stage. And I had really never seen anything like this because I had not put myself in spaces to go to concerts or to really be in uncomfortable physical spaces. And if you've ever seen her perform, like, I don't know how she does it. It's like, sometimes you go to a show and I'm like, I can see you like thinking about your laundry, like as you're performing. But Beyonce is just like there. She's right there. It's like every molecule of her body is like seeps out into like the audience. And the thing that really moved me about that was just the generosity of it. And I was really looking for a model of that. And I was really looking for someone to show me the value of it. So her incredible presence, the generosity of that, and then the effect it had on the crowd, which became like this living organism that would just like follow, you know, Beyonce would walk to this side of the stage and the crowd would reach for her. And like everyone was so ecstatic and like just to be in that like absolute just mass of humanity felt so incredible to me. And I thought, it's not her fame that really shifted anything for me. It's that act of what it means to give people like fully the experience of being present with them. And that's a gift I think she has more than most any other performer.
Well, we're happy you were present with us here tonight, and we're happy that you all were here present with us tonight. Let's give it up for Chloe Cooper-Jones.
Thank you.
Chloe will be signing, so if you had a last question, we didn't get to it, I apologize. But
Yeah, we'll be out here and hang out. I just want to say really quickly, thank you so much for having me. Thank you all for being here. And Isaac has a book out in July called Dirtbag Massachusetts, and it's so brilliant, and I hope you will get it, and I know he'll be back here too. So thank you, Isaac, for this.
That's a wonderful way to end it, but thank you to you, Chloe, and thank you to the Free Library. Thank you, Philadelphia. Yay!
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.